On the Sky News Centre at 6, detectives hunting Britain's most wanted man have uncovered fresh clues. Three mobile phones used by suspected gunman Raoul Moats have been recovered in Northumberland. He's believed to have shot three people, killing one of them, and has been hiding out for 7 days. Temporary Chief Constable Sue Sims given her officers some words of encouragement as they head out on the search again.
We are all in this together to provide support to the most important people, and that's our communities. I'm hugely proud to be your chief. I'm proud of every single one of you, and I know you're going to do an excellent job out there for us.
Russia and the United States have played out their biggest spy swap since the Cold War at Vienna Airport. 10 agents deported from America have been exchanged for 4 freed by Russia. A Royal Marine has been killed in an explosion in Sangin area of Helmand in Afghanistan. The serviceman from 40 Commando died while carrying out a foot patrol last night, his family has been told. A 15-year-old boy has been jailed for life after setting fire to the house of his ex-girlfriend, killing her and her elder sister. Akmal Mir will serve at least 23 years in prison for the arson attack in South London last year. Soaring temperatures have prompted this summer's first heat health alert for East Anglia and South East England. Norwich has been the warmest place so far at 30 Celsius. Hilary Evans from the charity Age UK has this advice.
We just want to make sure that people are prepared for the hot weekend that we've got ahead, but also making sure that other people who may have an elderly neighbour who lives on their own maybe just pop around and check they're okay, and then anything that they can do to support them.
In sport, Britain's Mark Cavendish has won the 6th stage of the Tour de France. It's the rider's 2nd consecutive stage victory. And in showbiz, Cheryl Cole is out of intensive care. The singer was being treated for malaria at University College London Hospital. She's been transferred to a private clinic. The star spent 6 days in Tanzania last month and was taking malaria tablets. That's the latest. I'm Rachel Jewell.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
If drink is costing you more than money, then help is just a phone call away.
Ring Alcoholics Anonymous on 0117 926 5520.
The telephones are manned 24 hours a day, 365 days a year,
by volunteers who are recovering alcoholics.
So they know what the illness feels like, the loneliness, the despair.
All help is free and confidential.
So if you'd like further information, then please contact us
on 0117 926 5520.
Or you can find us in your local telephone directory.
www.alcoholics-anonymous.org.uk.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with me, Tony Gosling, and Oxford economist Martin Summers. On the morning of September the 11th, 2001, 4 planes were hijacked in the eastern United States. One crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. One was flown into the hub of the US Department of Defense, the Pentagon. And most famously, 2 airliners were flown into the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center. The resulting invasion of Afghanistan has now lasted longer than World War II, and the wider so-called War on Terror has led to the illegal invasion of Iraq and permanent US military bases in the Middle East. Anyway, I'm joined now by author Ian Henshaw, who's a coffee importer and author of the 2007 book 9/11, The New Evidence. Hello, Ian, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, Tony.
Now, firstly, I'm intrigued. Is there any connection between 9/11 and coffee?
No, but I do sell fair trade coffee, so I suppose you could say having a social conscience is the common denominator.
So what credentials do you have to write a book like this?
It doesn't really matter what my credentials are, it's my evidence. I have got a background in alternative investigative journalism from the days of the Leveller magazine when Di Abbott and I were together on the executive there in the late 70s and murky past there.
Can you tell us about the Leveller magazine? What was that?
It was hugely supported by Tony Benn, actually, and it was named after the Levellers, of course, who were a historical movement. It was brought out by a bunch of Fleet Street journalists who couldn't get their story out, so there's no surprises there, you know. And they found out about the British torture in Northern Ireland, and in particular about hooding, which is a method of torture, and was found to be that, and led to lots of trouble in the 70s, when initially the media wouldn't publicise it, and then finally I think we were condemned by Amnesty International and the Council of Europe. And then, of course, as we now know, they immediately started doing it again in Iraq, and we saw it on TV, flagrant torture by the British, actually, I'm afraid to say, not just by the Americans. They say that they didn't know it was illegal, and that was all subject to a recent inquiry, of course. But that was the subject that really set off the Leveller magazine. They also used to investigate the Kennedy assassination, and I remember one of the journalists there coming in, and he'd just been to visit the editor of the Sunday Times. He worked on the Sunday Times, and they'd gone to the editor of the Sunday Times, who's regarded as a liberal nowadays, with a story about Kennedy assassination. Very good story. And the editor turned around and said, "No, we don't write this sort of story. These are friends of ours." So, you know, the mainstream media has always been, you know, if you like, primarily an arm of the government, and almost.
Well, that leads me to the next question. Did you have any trouble getting your little book published here, 9/11, The New Evidence?
Well, yeah. There was pretty much only one publisher that would take it on, Constable and Robinson. They had the sort of history, the respectability in the history that they felt they could risk it. But, you know, it's a bit of a myth to imagine that there's always a book publisher for any book that should be published. Most publishers are book publishers are, you know, extremely narrow-minded. The guy who was working for Constable and Robinson, who published my book, went on to work for a bigger publisher who I won't name, a household name publisher. And I said, "Hey, Dan, you know, now we can publish it with a bit of..." And he said, "You must be joking. I can't publish it now. I'm working for these people."
Now, there's no way, surely, that many people could have been involved in any kind of cover-up to do with September 11th and then not come forward.
Well, yes, there are lots of ways, actually. I mean, it's a bit like the old saying about the con artists. Con artists operate because people want to be conned. And I think that's basically what happened about 9/11, was that all the first wave of people who needed to believe it, needed to believe the official story. So, you know, the senior media editors, the politicians, the military, the people in the CIA and the FBI, they all wanted to believe that official story. They didn't want to believe that their own incompetence had allowed the 9/11 attacks to happen, and they certainly didn't want to believe that rogue elements in their own midst had actually, you know, permitted or even created the 9/11 attacks, which is what many people now suspect.
Everybody knows Islamic extremists wanted to attack America, and also Bin Laden certainly had the money to do it. Isn't it a bit racist to suggest that they weren't capable of planning and executing 9/11 in the way that we've been told officially?
No, it's not based on racial considerations. It is true, though, that one of the most suspicious aspects of the 9/11 attacks, which was obvious to a lot of people from day one, is that Al-Qaeda must have had an absolutely extraordinary step change in its resources and capabilities to go from sort of pathetic attempts to sink American ships with overloaded boats. The first attempt, you know, when they tried to sink the USS warship, the Cole, it was with a boat that sank because it was too overloaded with explosives. I mean, that's the level they were on. You know, as for piloting a plane, they didn't have any pilots. You know, even the official story people admit that Al-Qaeda didn't have any pilots in 2001. So, you know, the idea that they suddenly trained up four crack pilots who then carried out impeccable hijackings without hardly any weapons, if any, against military trained pilots, which they were in several cases, although they were civilian planes, that idea, you know, that they suddenly got that capability is, you know, highly suspicious, highly unlikely.
Now, some people might agree that the US military, or for, you know, certainly it may be people within the Pentagon, etc., may have let it happen. But the idea that they actually carried out these attacks is surely preposterous.
I wouldn't say it's preposterous. I mean, history is full of examples where governments fake attacks on their own people. I mean, the Americans did it with the Gulf of Tonkin events, which triggered off the Vietnam War, for instance. A lot of people believe that Israel did it to America with the USS Liberty attack in the 1960s. You could say, I think the legitimate question is, if it was, you know, a wholly run Pentagon or CIA conspiracy, how they could have expected to get away with it, how they could have kept it secret. There's a lot of questions about that. I'm certainly not saying from my researches that it definitely was entirely the CIA. But I do think also that if you follow the just let it happen approach, they just decided to drop the defences and to let something happen so as to gather support for an attack, which of course they had already planned against Iraq and Afghanistan. if you assume that it was a sort of let it happen scenario, and personally I don't think the military mind would be that happy about just giving the airspace over to a bunch of hijackers, because supposing they'd landed it, you know, and attacked a nuclear power station, you know, that I don't know how they could have eliminated that possibility.
But that's pretty damning to say that the attack on Iraq and Afghanistan was planned beforehand. Do you have any evidence for that?
Absolutely. It's there on all the paper trail. And you know, one thing I'd just like to say is that, you know, there are people out there who think that all this is all internet speculation, you know, and people sit on the internet making these things up. Everything in my book is taken from official sources and mainstream reports, and we know that the Project for a New American Century had already decided that they wanted to occupy Iraq. It's there in black and white in their documents brought out just a year before 9/11.
Now, one of the first chapters in your book is called A First Draft of History. Why did you call it that?
Because that was, you know, what the media claims to produce. You know, it's a saying that journalists use, we write the first draft of history. And of course the problem with that is that it carries the implication that the first draft is close to the truth, and that it'll just be revised in the second and third drafts. But the problem is that if you immediately get off on totally the wrong direction, then the first draft of history can be, you know, just a load of rubbish, which pretty much, I'm afraid to say, the official story about 9/11 is.
Well, would you like to explain why you think, well, the most important reasons you think that this first draft of history in the case of 9/11 was, as you said, a load of rubbish?
Well, there's a very many reasons for thinking that, and that's one of the most powerful arguments against the official story. But as I said, you know, the first point is the capability of Al-Qaeda, extraordinary, almost impossible jump in their capabilities. Another reason is the, for instance, the what we now know to be a fake or, you know, very suspicious evidence trail that was laid, with Mohammed Atta's bag being ostensibly found, even though it was supposed to have crashed in the plane, but just conveniently, you know, giving lots of information which made the story, you know, look true. You had allegedly a passport found that couldn't possibly have happened that apparently survived the attack on the World Trade Center, and within about an hour had been discovered by a citizen and identified as one of the hijackers' passports. Well, that's just so silly, you know. We all saw that inferno, the idea of a hijacker's passports being found in the chaos at the bottom of the street, being identified as a hijacker. Why would they identify that passport as a hijacker's passport? So that was another. I could go on for half an hour, Tony. Another huge and very odd coincidence, which the official story has never even confronted, is that they had an anti-hijack exercise that morning running at the Pentagon. Well, what are the chances of that? Now, you know, listeners might think, well, so what? You know, the point is that if you are running some sort of a false flag operation, you need to create cover stories and confusion. So if you were, for instance, decided you were going to run a fake hijacking and blame Al-Qaeda for it, then you'd need to have some cover for if something went wrong with your plot. And the best cover would be if you have a hijack exercise going on that morning. So, you know, you can see very much how that hijack exercise fits into the more suspicious scenario. But, you know, according to the official story, it was just an extraordinary coincidence. And there are many of those coincidences.
Now, Martin Summers is joining us too. Martin, what for you are the big problems with the official story? Because I know you're very sceptical about the official version of events on 9/11.
I think there's lots of reasons to be suspicious of the official story, and many of them are covered in Ian's excellent book. But I think the obvious point to make to people is that this is the most heavily defended airspace in the world. The Pentagon is the most heavily defended spot on the planet, and we've got planes flying around for up to an hour and a half with no interception taking place whatsoever. What happened to the United States Air Force on the morning of the attack? We're told that for all kinds of reasons they were not capable of intercepting any of these planes. But we know in the previous year 60-odd planes went off course in the United States. They were all intercepted within 5 minutes. What happened on September the 11th? Where was the United States Air Force? Simple question. And of course, the other killer fact is that three buildings collapsed on September the 11th in New York City. Not two, three. WTC7, people just put it into a Google search, you will see a video of the third building coming down. It comes down exactly the same as the other two, straight down, like a controlled demolition, no planes, no fire. Perhaps Ian would like to comment. I mean, the Nils Harriet of Copenhagen University has peer-reviewed in all of the industry journals, pointing out that there was nanothermite in the rubble. Nanothermite, high-level explosive. The US government doesn't want to comment about this, but that's the facts. Well, nanothermite was in the rubble.
Is it not possible that Al-Qaeda actually bombed the building at the same time?
Yes, but that's not the story we're being told, are we? We're being told that that planes crashed into buildings and then they collapsed because of fires. Now, if there are bombs in the buildings, how did Al-Qaeda get access to the buildings to bomb them? Much more likely somebody inside the US security forces, surely.
Now, Ian, another thing in your book, you talk quite early on, really, about connections between the Central Intelligence Agency, the US Intelligence Service, and Al-Qaeda. What did you find out about that?
Well, they're now saying, you know, they're trying to distance themselves from the 80s when they were training the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, as we heard earlier, you know, with their heroin trafficking, which now seems to have been started up again now that the Taliban are back and the British Army are there and so on. I'm sorry, Tony.
Yeah, it's about this connections between the Central Intelligence Agency and Al-Qaeda, because I think that they were, at least the inception of Al-Qaeda was actually a US intelligence thing in the first place. It seems like this is a kind of blowback incident.
Oh, it's
where
totally blowback.
They have trained up these people who have then almost been like double agents and come back and got them.
Well, the most revealing book about the CIA was written by the most senior guy who ever left the CIA and blew the whistle, a man called John Stockwell, and the book was called In Search of Enemies. And that basically is the general methodology of the warmongering section of the Washington establishment, is that for them the worst thing is peace. Peace doesn't make any money. It's bad for your empire if you're in the CIA operations department or the Pentagon. So the suggestion is that they go around stirring up trouble, and then, you know, whatever happens, they win. I mean, Iraq has been described as a defeat, but, you know, there's a lot of money being made out of it. If the measure is money made by people in Washington, Iraq has been a huge success. So is Afghanistan. War is good news. You know, we're all having to learn again what we learned after the First World War, you know, that the people who benefit from war, there are a lot of people who benefit from war, and they're mainly people in the world of money and industry.
Now, there were also several warnings, and it's always a little bit, it seems a little bit sort of cheeky to say afterwards, well, you were warned. Now, obviously, there are terrorist warnings going on all the time, but you actually talk about paralysis at the Federal Bureau of Investigations.
Yeah, it went way beyond warnings. It's true that, you know, they can make a defense that a warning has to be very specific before they can act on it. But the problem was that there were people acting on the warnings, and they were stopped from acting anymore. There were FBI agents who were onto the alleged hijackers who would have aborted the 9/11 if they'd been allowed to continue their work. But they were angrily and very, very aggressively told to stop their investigations. And this wasn't just one office. This was a couple of different investigations. This is what I mean by coincidence. If this was all some sort of a bureaucratic screw-up, then, you know, what a terrible coincidence. Why two FBI offices? You know, you don't expect lightning to strike twice. Also, there's now evidence from the CIA side that they were the people who were blocking the FBI. And we also now know from the official documents, or at least the reports of the people involved in the 9/11 Commission, that the CIA actually refused to tell anybody about any of their covert operations running up to 9/11. So for all we know, the CIA might have had a covert operation that was pretty much at the official level, allowing the 9/11 attacks to continue, but say with a plan to stop them at the last minute or something like that. It's all murky, Tony, but what we can say for sure is that the simple fairy tale version, Al-Qaeda bad, CIA good, of the 9/11 attacks is a load of rubbish.
But it's not like the London bombings, the 7/7 attack, where there hasn't been any kind of proper public inquiry or anything. In the US, they had the 9/11 Commission, and their report basically backed up the official story.
Well, it was taken to back up the official story, and certainly the headline, as with all government reports, they always do. But if the question, even in the small print of the 9/11 Commission, there was a lot of evidence that actually refuted the official story. And since then, the commissioners have come out to basically say, you know, we were lied to. They're actually saying we were lied to by the Pentagon. And that's all to do with the anti-hijack exercise. You see, the other odd thing about the anti-hijack exercise is that they didn't just put their hands up afterwards and say, well, you know, this would be the sensible thing to do. If you've got any political savvy at all, you'd look at that, you think, oh my God, we were running an anti-hijack exercise that very morning. My goodness, this is going to lead to lots of suspicions. The only honest thing to do is to come right out and admit it and face the flak and explain why it didn't have any connection with 9/11. Did they do that? No, they didn't. They kept it totally secret. They tried to wipe tapes, which the 9/11 Commission managed to recreate. They did everything they could to deny the existence of that anti-hijack exercise.
Another chapter is called The Hijackers, Terrorists or Patsies. Well, what do you mean by a patsy?
Well, a patsy is what, if you know, those of us who are old enough to remember the Kennedy assassination, the guy who was alleged to have assassinated Kennedy was arrested, and pretty much the only thing he said in public was, I am a patsy, and then he was murdered by somebody while in police custody, which made a lot of people very suspicious about the Kennedy assassination. But patsy is an American term meaning somebody who does something, but is a bit of an idiot and gets helped along their way, who couldn't do something without help from other people, a sort of straw man, if you like.
Okay, and so what makes you think that potentially that these alleged hijackers were patsies and not actually terrorists?
Well, because they didn't have the capability. They didn't have the capability even to get into the country. I mean, even when you look at the stage, every step of the story, as I told you, has weird coincidences and impossibilities. But when you look at, for instance, the visa applications, you find that all of them should have been refused entry. The visa applications were just a joke. The 9/11 Commission couldn't even find the visa applications for the alleged hijackers, who are the suspected CIA. You know, I mean, a lot of people think that Mohammed Atta probably wasn't even on the plane.
He's the lead hijacker,
he
was
the alleged lead hijacker.
Yeah, it's not even clear that the planes were hijacked. In your introduction, you said planes were hijacked.
Well, weren't they?
Well, it's not clear. It's not clear that they were. I mean, the FBI have admitted that the named hijackers were using false identities. So we just don't know whether anybody was on those planes or not.
And if you look at it, you know, very closely and just do the work, which the media should be doing, and I'm sure lots of foreign intelligence services have done and come to the same conclusion, you find that every element of the official story, when you examine it in detail, it breaks down. So, for instance, you find that the moment when the planes were supposed to have been, one of the planes was supposed to have been hijacked, it's exactly the same moment that one of the key wonderful witnesses who allegedly lost their husband or partner on the plane was phoned up by that person. Well, he was in the area where there should have been somebody having their throat slit that very second, and yet he's making a calm phone call as reported by his friend. Did you see what I mean? Wherever you look, it doesn't add up. Another place that it doesn't add up at all is the seismic reports, where the seismic record shows that the impact happened about 30 seconds before.
This is the sort of things that detect earthquakes, isn't
it?
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. The seismic records show that the collision with the Twin Towers happened 30 seconds before, approximately 30 seconds before the aviation records show. Now, nowadays, everybody works on Universal Standard Time. You know, even a tenth of a second would be odd, but 30-second difference, that just won't wash. I mean, a lot of people think that there were bombs went off before the planes hit the buildings as well, and there are eyewitness accounts to that, and that would seem to be the best explanation for that particular.
Can I just cut in? You mentioned foreign intelligence services having investigated this, and I've mentioned this gentleman before on this show, General Leonid Ivashov, Ivashov. He was commander-in-chief of the Russian armed forces on September the 11th. He is out there in internet land pointing out that, as far as I am concerned, this was an inside job by the Israelis and the Americans. And that's the Russian general staff. They are in a position to know. They will have spies, they will have bugs, they will know what's happened. And of course, the Russian general staff presumably are working on the assumption, as are the Iranian general staff, that this was an inside job.
So, Ian, who was the first around the world to start coming out with books and material that was questioning the official version of events? Because you've actually got a chapter, another chapter entitled The Skeptical View Develops.
Well, I think really it was the internet initially. You know, people who were very suspicious of other events, such as the Kennedy assassination or the Vince Foster scandal in Washington that happened a few years earlier.
Are these sort of people, surely they would, anything that happened, they would find suspicious.
Totally, yeah, no doubt, no question. But, you know, they dredged up a lot of evidence. And then the next wave of people came in and started looking at the evidence and thinking, well, can we explain this? Can we explain that? And these things can get quite complicated. So, for instance, Tony said the planes weren't intercepted correctly, but he didn't mean shot down, you know, because there's a lot of people on the internet said, oh, well, they should have shot the planes down. Why didn't they shoot the planes down? Well, of course, you know, there's an explanation for that, which is you wouldn't trust the American Air Force pilots not to shoot the wrong planes down, and then there'd be lawsuits for the next 50 years from the people who'd been incorrectly shot down. So you can understand why they didn't shoot the planes down. But, you know, the interception should still have taken place, and the planes followed. That was the standard procedures, and they were thrown out the window that day. So yeah, you know, there is a lot of debate to be had, and nobody's saying that, you know, in a sense 9/11 was an inside job. Doesn't mean that the CIA did the whole thing. I'm not suggesting that. I think probably there were some hijacker people who wanted to hijack planes or wanted to get even with America, but who was controlling them and who was helping them along their way and who was guiding the plan, basically.
Now, back to the collapse of the three towers, as we've heard, not just the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center, but this Building 7, World Trade Center Building 7. Now, there are many speculative theories about why these buildings collapsed. The obvious one is that the planes crashed in, there were massive fires raging, and that was what caused the collapse.
Well, you know, there's a lot of reasons to reject that simple argument. For me, as somebody with scientific background, the most persuasive argument is that this was all debated at the time that the Twin Towers were built. There was a ferocious debate between architects, engineers, the whole, you know, the establishment, the people of New York. They all looked at the question because the Statue of Liberty had been hit. This is near an airport. Nobody was thinking about terrorist attacks, but they were worried about rogue planes going out of control, and of course a plane coming into land or taking off, it can be traveling pretty fast, it can be fully laden, it can have a load of petrol on board. That's what they were worried about, and everybody decided these buildings were safe if they were hit by an aircraft. Even if they were hit at full speed by a fully laden jet, they would not collapse. There'd be a nasty fire, but it would burn itself out because it was a steel frame building, and steel by and large resists fire.
Another chapter is entitled The War on Information. Why did you decide to look at the war on information?
Well, I think for people who generally trust what they read in the mainstream media, and I used to, so I've got, you know, I sympathize with people, you know, life's too short to go around doubting everything if you're not in the business of trying to find out what's going on. For people like that, I think, you know, the most odd thing about 9/11 is why on earth haven't the media blown the whistle? If it's so obvious that the official story of 9/11 can't be true, why haven't the media blown the whistle on it? And in particular, why haven't the foreign media? And I looked into this, and it turns out that basically, even in countries that are taken to be hostile to America, like France, the media follows the Washington line, the Washington media line, totally as if it was gospel truth. If you can get a story onto the Associated Press, pretty much every country in the world will accept that story as being true without the slightest further inquiries. And then, of course, I found out that the Pentagon is actually actively manipulating debate, and a lot of those very lunatic, angry people that you see on discussion forums, either for or against 9/11 official story, you know, a lot of them are just sitting in the Pentagon, basically, you know, being paid by taxpayers' money to put out disinformation and confusing allegations.
Now let's have a little look at maybe who did do it, if it wasn't Osama bin Laden and his friends. Now we heard from former head of studies at the US Army War College, Dr. Alan Zabrowski, a couple of months ago on this programme, who he believes carried out the 9/11 attacks. Let's have another listen to that report now.
What we need to stand up and say is not only did they attack the USS Liberty, they did 9/11. They did it. I have had long conversations over the past 2 weeks with contacts at the Army War College, at Headquarters Marine Corps, and I've made it absolutely clear in both cases that it is 100% certain that 9/11 was a Mossad operation, period. For most Americans, you know, what happened to the USS Liberty or in Vietnam was history. You know, they can be concerned about it, but they're not going to get mad about it. 9/11 has led directly to 60,000 Americans dead and wounded. God knows how many hundreds of thousands of people in other countries that we've killed or wounded or made homeless. And it's an ongoing sore. Well, this is an open wound. And what Americans need to understand is they did it. Mm-hmm. They did it. And if they do understand that, Israel's going to disappear. Well, if Americans ever know that Israel did this, they're going to scrub them off the earth. And they're not going to give a rat's ass, forgive my language, what the cost is. They are not going to care.
Now, that's a pretty strong accusation, but it's coming from someone who was actually head of studies at the American Army War College. Martin, what are your thoughts on that one?
Yes, Saborsky, is that the name? Can you spell it out so the listeners can look it up?
S-A-B-R-O-S-K-Y.
Yes,
Dr. Alan Saborsky.
Yeah, he's actually, as you say, a senior US military figure on the training side of the US military. He's also a Jewish person. So he's a very independent-minded fellow, and he's saying that senior US military do realise that Mossad, which is the Israeli intelligence services, were the main brains behind 9/11. I mean, leaving aside all the things we've been talking about, our suspicions, out there in the real world, beyond the media bubble in Middle America and Middle England, lots of people know that 9/11 was carried out by the state, by the Israelis, by the CIA. It's a common knowledge. I was in a trade union delegation to Colombia 5 years ago. We were talking to local activists there and saying, well, we suspect that 9/11 was an inside job, and their answer to that was claro. It's obvious.
But this sounds incredible. What possible motive could the Israelis have?
Well, don't forget that a lot of wars have now taken place, which have been very much in Israel's geopolitical interest. They've taken out, and we're just about possibly to go to war with Iran again in Israel's geopolitical interest. You know, it's got concatenation of forces behind this. What we suspect, Israel obviously plays a prominent role. Israelis were arrested at the 9/11 events, clapping and cheering, and photographing the first plane hitting a building. They were arrested by local police, but then they were let go. And then on Israeli TV, they came up on Israeli TV and said, we were just documenting the event, documenting a surprise attack which nobody knew was going to happen. How did they do that if they didn't know what was going to happen?
Now, one of the most incredible recordings was only released several years after the 9/11 attacks. It's the sound of the brave New York firemen who were fighting the fire just before the building collapsed. Here's one of the last bits of that recording before the collapse, which suggests the fire in the South Tower was nearly out just before the collapse. It's not very clear, but you can just make out a firefighter saying, "We got two pockets of fire, we should be able to knock it down with two lines."
5, 4, 1, 5. We got two. I saw the pockets of fire. We should be able to knock it down with two lines. Where are you? There you go, next.
Keith, what
stair are
you in?
South Tower, Adam. South Tower.
All right, South Tower, we're on our way.
Now, Ian, what about that? I mean, because that does suggest that maybe the firefighters were actually on top of the trouble just before the collapse happened.
Well, we'll never know to be sure, but that certainly is what that indicates. And that guy, actually, I found out doing the research for my book, cross-referencing, that firefighter was actually not a normal firefighter. He was one of their experts on terrorism, and he'd made a particular study of the structure of the World Trade Center. So the fact that he thought that they could put it out easily is, you know, he wasn't just some sort of, you know, rookie fireman who made a misjudgment. That's the problem with the story about the collapse of the towers. I mentioned how, you know, previously scientists had decided it couldn't happen. So normally in science, you know, when something happens which you thought couldn't happen, you've got two assumptions. You either go back and you look to where you made your mistake, or you look at other explanations for how it might happen, i.e. explosives pre-laid in the towers. And let's remember, to some people it sounds preposterous, you know, that there might have been explosives in the towers, but supposing the CIA had gone to the owners and said, well, we know there's going to be an attack, but we can't say which plane's going to do it. So to save the towers from falling over horizontally and causing really terrible damage, we need to just have an emergency plan to bring them down tidily so that, we can save a lot of lives. You can imagine that they would have found a legal justification for putting bombs in the towers. Demolition. Some people think that all tall buildings are built with the option of demolishing them.
I think if people are interested in these technical questions, they should go to the website of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, which has 1,000 specialists, architects and engineers, all of whom are saying that the official story simply can't be true. And don't forget, we're talking about planes causing fires. A third building collapsed, which no plane hit and wasn't on fire. How did that happen? Much more likely that all three buildings were destroyed by explosives. And we've got eyewitnesses like William Rodriguez, who was a janitor in the World Trade Center. We had him here a couple of years ago, saying, look, there were bombs in the I was in the basement and a bomb went off.
He's the eyewitness who corroborates the seismic record that the bomb off before the plane hit the building.
Now, let's have a look now at some of the geopolitical fallout from 9/11, which is really the war on terror. Jimmy Massey left the US Marine Corps in 2006 after his tour of duty in Iraq, but not before he'd been privy to some pretty shocking intelligence briefings that indicated to him that the US has a simple covert mission to dominate the world.
We will stay in Iraq until we bleed the Iraqis of all of their oil. And then we will move to Iran, Syria, and whoever else we think has oil or has natural resources that we can rape.
Do you think they would go so far as to take Venezuela's oil by force?
This is World War III. There are no rules. The rules went out the window September 11th.
Is this just your personal opinion, or did someone actually tell you this as your time as a soldier?
My 12 years of intelligence briefings within the U.S. Marine Corps has led me to believe one thing. The U.S. has a quest for global domination. Marines are gangsters for capitalism. I say for all the people here in Venezuela that do not believe in President Chavez, you better start believing. The wolf is north of you. The media within the United States has blinded the American people. And the number one person that has blinded the Americans with propaganda is Bill O'Reilly, Fox News. Mr. O'Reilly is supposedly Irish, but I think he's more fascist.
How many ex-soldiers are in your organization?
We have approximately 600 active members that speak worldwide, and we have 2,000 members that are in reserve that are waiting for the revolution. The revolution has already began. It's just, when are we going to take it to the White House?
You're saying 600 soldiers that are already withdrawn, or are there still some that are active?
The 600 are already withdrawn, and a lot of the 2,000 are members that are still within the U.S. military. And we have members that even work within the National Security Agency in Maryland. We are surrounding them. It simplifies things.
That was ex-staff sergeant from the U.S. Marine Corps, Jimmy Massey, there speaking on Venezuelan television. But I'll ask both of you this. What is the implication here? Because it sounds to me like there are certain of these Iraq veterans against the war who are planning a kind of civil war in the U.S. Is this a realistic possibility?
Well, it happened in the 70s after Vietnam. A lot of bombs went off in America in the 70s. There was a thing called the Weather Underground, and it wasn't particularly publicised, but there were, thousands of bombs went off. And, of course, famously, when America bombed Cambodia, pretty much every major high street in America was trashed by demonstrators. Of course, the big difference now is that they don't have a conscript army. So, the youth can just sort of basically sit this one out, and they're not going to be dragged out to Vietnam or Iraq or Afghanistan anytime soon. I don't know how realistic it is, really. I know that we're in a very... I think the situation here is actually not dissimilar from Eastern Europe before the fall of the communists. You know, we've got this sort of self-congratulatory elite whose propaganda is, you know, very effective, but ever more distanced from reality. And at some point, you know, the bubble has to burst. When it's going to burst, I don't know. But, I mean, you've got this oil slick now, you know, where they're just covering it up. They're using national security to cover up the incompetence of BP. I mean, maybe that's too much. At some point, history shows regimes that are out of control go too far, and then, you know, events catch up with them. So I definitely think something might happen.
Now, New York's Ralph Schoenemann is a left-wing thinker and writer and lecturer. Back in 2007, he gave a talk about American politics in relation to the 9/11 attacks, which he sees as a spectacular event designed to manipulate politicians and public alike into further wars. He believes the US press is very weak and the government doesn't even bother to get their official story straight.
The Bush administration, not having found any trace of Osama bin Laden, declared a great victory. And here's the account of it in Asia Times, a chilling inheritance of terror. The author is Saeed Salem Shahzad. Ever since the frenzied shootout last month on September 11th in Karachi, it has been confirmed that Kuwaiti national Khalid Sheikh Mohammed did indeed perish in the raid. His wife and child were taken from the apartment and handed over to the FBI, in whose hands they remain. Well, they killed him on the first anniversary of 9/11. I'll just mention this, that on March 1st, 2003, they staged a raid in Karachi on the home of the retarded son of a prominent microbiologist, where they captured Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Now, all of the witnesses and the testimony of the police officers and all of those engaged in the raid confirm that who they took into custody was a 42-year-old retarded son of the microbiologist and his wife and child. They make this stuff up as they go along, brothers and sisters. Mohammed Atta, trained at Maxwell Air Force Base with his address at the Naval Air Station in Pensacola, Florida. The supposed instrument of 9/11 under who? The aegis of Ramzi Youssef, the nephew of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. It is a tissue of lies. It is a pattern of fabrication. It is the psyops with which we are to be mesmerized into numbed acquiescence. Everything that comes out of this ruling class, as Mary McCarthy once famously, if perhaps unjustly, said about Lillian Hellman, everything is a lie, including and thee. So we have to seize a certain reality about these masters of our fate, that this rotten and corrupt and brutal and genocidal ruling class cannot be persuaded. They cannot be changed. They cannot be reformed. They cannot be contained. They have to be removed. They have to be overthrown, brothers and sisters. We should not shrink from that task or fail to speak truth to our people. We have to mobilize the many in pursuit of our very survival as a society, for this is a system in terminal decay. and the baton falls to our generation to meet it with resistance, without prevarication, without any hesitation about calling their lies by their name and exposing their crimes for what they are, because that is the predicate for the task before us of fundamental change and of overthrow and of transformation of a society that is in their hands at great risk and to all of us. Thanks so much.
That's New York's Ralph Schoenemann there, who's a left-wing writer and lecturer, speaking back in 2007. Now, Ian, he's talking there about the ruling class, and I imagine he's coming from a sort of Marxist perspective. What are your thoughts about whether, you know, this is something which is, you know, actually a class issue?
Oh, crikey.
Because, I mean, I know it's a bit of an awkward question, possibly, but, you know, I would have thought that there are some people in the ruling class who are really rather frustrated and annoyed if they believe that 9/11 actually wasn't the way it was originally told. It's not really a class issue, is it?
It depends on what you call the ruling class. I think what we've now got to the stage, we're well beyond the stage that Marx saw, where, you know, there was a load of bourgeois, upper middle class people, you know, and who together with the landowners and the aristocracy constituted the ruling class. What we're in now is, I think, more comparable to Germany, you know, around the time of Hitler, when a section of the ruling class, a very dysfunctional and aggressive section of the ruling class, has basically seized control. And yes, I think there are other sectors of the ruling class who are more, you know, cautious and would be, you know, quite much more happy going back to the sort of United Nations Charter, which we all thought was the law, you know, until 2003 when Iraq was invaded. And of course, with hindsight, the fact that they acquiesced in the rise of the Nazis in Germany was an absolute disaster for the more modern sectors of the German economy, who didn't need a war. You know, and there are many sectors of the American economy, they don't need a war. You know, Hollywood doesn't need a war. And of course, funnily enough, it's in Hollywood where you find that a lot of the dissent to the official 9/11 story.
The one thing that made Hitler so popular in the 1930s was the economic miracle.
Well, he adopted Keynesian economics. I'm sure Martin knows more about economics than I do here, but the problem at the moment is that you know, they did create an economic miracle, actually, and they made it pretty clear that, of course, one thing that's very little discussed as people talk about the financial crisis is A, the cost of the wars, which are enormous, but probably not more than the NHS, you know, so they're not spectacularly enormous, but they're pretty big. They're definitely well worth cutting. But far more to the point was that the Fed, which created the bubble, which collapsed, as we all know, in 2008, Alan Greenspan is pretty much on record as saying that he created that bubble to distract people from the costs that they should have been paying for the Iraq war and the Afghan war in 2003. In other words, they had a fake boom to power their way through the extra expenses of those wars, and that boom has now expired big time.
Yeah, and it's quite interesting that the Fed opened the money tap after September the 11th. They said, "Oh, we've got September the 11th gave them the excuse to reboot the economy by printing money." Effectively, there should have been a crash. The dot-com bubble had just crashed. That's when the crash should have taken place, but it didn't take place because at that point, because of 9/11, we opened the money tap and we run a huge bubble for the following decade, which of course then finally hits the wall in 2008. And of course, we're about to hit the wall again, and this time it's going to be much harder than 2008. There's no safety net now. The government has spent all the money that it's got to spend. We're going to hit the wall at 100 miles an hour and our heads going through the windscreen. Now, behind all of this is a criminal section of the ruling class, allied to finance capital, related to the war industries, and also intelligence services like Mossad.
And this, as I was just going to say, Martin, yeah, when you said that, you know, this is where you get back to Alan Sobrovsky, you know, and the allegation that 9/11 was carried out by Mossad. I wouldn't confirm or deny that allegation. It is just an allegation as far as I'm concerned at the moment. I don't think we know enough. All these things go on in secret. What you can say is that Mossad and the CIA and the Pentagon and Wall Street are all pretty much in cahoots with each other, and that, you know, whichever particular section, and the media, by the way, whichever particular section masterminded 9/11, you know, I think we don't know at the moment. We know that quite a lot of people helped, you know, probably helped, if you reject the official story. And I think the model you need is networks within the structures. So it wasn't like Mossad. There are lots of people in Mossad who are perfectly innocent people. Some of them have defected. Ditto the CIA. The point is that you can create, you know, one person's network is another person's conspiracy. And so what you've got is a bunch of very sinister networks at the top level of the global echelon who are operating in their own interests. And probably the main motivation is money.
Well, we are still in Afghanistan after 2001, we and the Americans and many other nations too, but we've pulled out of Iraq. Surely what's happened, you know, this whole business of September the 11th, its actual effect on what's happening today is now decreasing gradually, and probably in the next few years will just disappear.
Well, that's the optimistic view. The pessimistic view is that they've set up a national security culture now, which enables them to seize people anywhere in the world, assassinate, ship them, you know, without warrant or whatever. And that, you know, they can now, okay, you know, the statute book is actually replete with old draconian laws which have fallen into disuse. So I'm not totally a pessimist on this one, but definitely they've shifted things way to the in the direction of, you know, police state. It's not visible to most people yet, but it is actually now to the people in the Gulf of Mexico who are getting arrested for taking photographs. You know, that they couldn't have done that before 9/11. They would have had a lot of trouble.
And do you think it's, Martin, do you think this is going to have an effect in the Middle East still, the sort of fallout from 9/11 and the war on terror?
Well, what we've got to be aware of is further false flag attacks. You know, because, as you say, the drugs are wearing off, and people are beginning to question whether we are justified in these imperial adventures by 9/11. The danger is that further attacks will take place. But that is the whole point of us exploring all of these issues today on this programme and in Ian's book. We are trying to deter whoever it is behind these attacks. If there is another attack, as there was in London 5 years ago, we're going to be all over it. We suspect that you're up to something, and we are going to be all over it. We're going to be looking at everything with a fine-tooth comb, and the internet now allows this kind of herd intelligence, this swarm intelligence, to work. There's lots and lots of people out there all digging away at every little detail of this story, and in the long run that is going to count.
But the next attack
also,
might
also, you know, every time somebody goes to an MP and says, oh, you know, I think you should look into the 9/11 attacks, I think that might have been an inside job, and the MP goes, I'm not taking any notice of that, actually they're going off privately and wondering if it's true. These guys are very conspiratorial, and you bet that for every MP who's come out and questioned 9/11, there have been a small handful, you know, there's another 50 who are privately totally you know, suspicious, and might not, if, as ministers, allow another one to go ahead.
Well, as you know, Ian, you've helped to organise, how many meetings in the House of Commons have you organised now?
About three or four so far.
Yeah, we've had three or four meetings in the House of Commons, which of course the MPs that have turned up, we're not saying who they are, because it's we're trying to keep that quiet, because obviously they don't want necessarily to be outed, as it were. But you know, we're doing our best to make sure that people don't die of ignorance.
And what
they
about
live in fear of the media, actually.
Do they?
The media are the secret weapon of the American Empire, no doubt about it. And, you know,
do you think British MPs really think that?
No, sorry, I think that.
Okay.
But the MPs are in fear of the media. Yes, they know very well that something, if you say things which offend Israel, which offend, you know, the Pentagon, they will offend the British government, and you will get into trouble.
Why?
The media will attack you. Well, I think they're cowardly. I mean, personally, if David Aronovitz or, you know, one of these ghastly spokesmen for Israel in the media attacks me, I don't really care at all, you know. And in fact, I assume that if I see somebody under attack, that probably means they're a good guy. So, but unfortunately, MPs seem to have a much more cautious approach to life. Maybe they're worried about their mortgages.
Well, a lot of them, let's face it, come into politics through local politics. So what they go into politics for, first of all, is to get the rubbish collected, to sort out the policing issues, as we were discussing with Gary earlier. And of course, that is the way in which they come into politics. They don't come into it through intelligence work or through military background. Yeah. So of course, they're a bit at sea when it comes to these issues. You know, they're not trained to deal with them.
Well, this gets onto the issue of professional politicians, of course, because, you know, in the old days, I mean, for instance, Dennis Healey, you know, he'd actually had quite active war experience, you know, and he'd been in the intelligence corps.
Okay, we're going to be winding up in a minute, but your book is about 250 pages long. Whereabouts can we get hold of it?
Some bookshops, it's still selling, but Amazon's probably the best place to get it from. I'm sorry to say, I'd like to support local bookshops, but it was brought out 3 years ago, and although it's doing very well not to be deleted, it is mainly available through Amazon nowadays.
And what about websites? You mentioned Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth.
And Reinvestigate.
Yeah, well, the Reinvestigate 9/11 website is, I'm ashamed to say, it needs updating, actually. But it's a good starting point.
Okay, well, thanks ever so much for joining us, Ian Henshaw, author of 9/11, The New Evidence. In fact, it's subtitled The Original Bestseller, Fully Updated and Revised with Startling New Facts. And I'm going to give the final word to thriller writer and World War II deception planner in Churchill's War Cabinet, Dennis Wheatley. What does he make of it all?
The devil was part of the original creation, and if you believe in God, then you must believe in the devil. That, of course, has nothing to do with Christian religion at all. There are two influences. One for light, under which everything grows and burgeons, blossoms, and one is darkness, in which everything decays and dies. And in any part of the world, within the year, the same hours of darkness and light supervene. And you have these two invisible influences striving for the soul of man. We don't know why, any more we know what is eternity.
And you believe that light and darkness, right and left, good and evil, are two absolutely separate but equally powerful
warring powers. And the devil is only just a name for power of evil.
That was Dennis Wheatley. Anyway, that's all for this week. Coming up next, the Sky News at 7 o'clock. And after that, Friday night is music night. Stand by for our mashup to the weekend. You'll be in the capable hands of the sumptuous Sam, a.k.a. DJ Spungold. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time each week here on BCFM 93.2. If you have a story for us, questions about this evening's programme, or want to suggest a guest for a future show, go to thisweek.org.uk. Or email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Thanks very much to this week's guest in the first hour. That's Lib Dem Councillor for Knoll and Cabinet Member for Community Safety, Gary Hopkins. Thanks too to Marina Morris and author of 9/11 The New Evidence, Ian Henshaw, and Oxford economist Martin Summers. Next week, the City of London are dangling the deficit like a sword of Damocles over Britain. But economics graduates Ben Curtis and Ben Dyson have drawn up something called the Bank of England Act 2010. They're monetary reformers, and they say if their act is passed, it will wipe out the deficit, correct fundamental errors in our money system, and we can start building schools and stop redundancies immediately. Does it sound too good to be true? Join us from 5 till 7 next week. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear all our previous Friday Drive Times, including an hour-long report on mobile phone masts and wireless safety, an extended interview with Managing Editor of BBC Radio Bristol, Tim Pemberton, our investigation into leadership charity Common Purpose, as well as our special on the Good Friday Agreement and Irish history. Just go to thisweek.org.uk and click on the link to our archives. A podcast of this show is usually online by the midnight after broadcast. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. We have about 60 million people in Britain and 60 million acres of land. So while it might seem there's not enough resources to go around, that's only because banks and big business have hijacked far more than their fair share. All we have to do is make sure that 60 million acres is shared out fairly, and with modern technology, not controlled by a power elite, we can all live happily together. Do please join us on Friday Drive Time at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down. And we're going to finish this week with Consolidated from 1991. This is called America Number One.
Down.
FM. It is your voice and it is your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.